international loaned finance. We are looking at the nature, structure and operation of the euro loan market of the larger euro dollar system. The euro dollar market develops after the Second World War. We essentially have a loan market, a bond market and an underlying interbank market. We're going to now focus particularly on the loan section of this and the euro loan market. I have provided a core chapter which outlines all of the key points in this. So we can look at this in terms of the historical development and background to the euro loan market, euro loan facilities or and other term loan uses and applications, loan structures, issue procedure, syndication, lead bank and agent bank liability, loan conditions and obligations, and that particularly specifically includes the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and then the covenants. We'll then look at loan default, default remedies, loan transfers, and loan restructuring. All of this is provided in the chapter. The basic background to the market is introduced at the beginning with all of the core points with regards to the evolution of the euro dollar market after the Second World War, but also the earlier use and application of lending practices going back to ancient Roman and Greek times. I've also specifically included a footnote, you'll see there in footnote 3. This was about the Chinese government transferring funds after the Second World War, and they wanted to move their assets to the Banque Commerciale pour l'Europe du Nord, and the cable address for that was Eurobank. So some people think the name Eurodollar originated with that cable address Eurobank. I'm not sure if that's altogether the case. The Eurodollar market simply, more generally, refers to the transfer of dollar assets following the Second World War from the American financial system, principally through New York, to London through the main American banks that set up operations in London. Eurodollar then refers to dealing in dollar debt in London, or more generally, to any funding or financial facilities that are denominated in a currency outside the country of issuance. So it then applies to any other currencies dealt with in London apart from sterling, and then again more widely to any other financial dealings in any other of the main principal financial centres outside the currency of the particular centre. The chapter then looks at euro loans and the particular use and application of term financing. What we're looking at is the nature of a term loan. A term loan is a specific loan for a particular period of time. That's why it's referred to as a term loan. This is as opposed to a revolving loan or an overdraft or what we call a credit line for a company, which are rolling and revolving. Term loans are for fixed periods. These can be quite long. It might be 10 years, it might be 15 years, you can see 20 years, very common, 20 to 30, but you can also see 40 and possibly up to 50 years. These tend to be offered by international financial institutions such as the World Bank, but you can get long-term agreements. You can also get short-term agreements, 1 year and even less than 1 year. The point is that these are distinct because they are for specific periods rather than for a revolving open commitment. We can then use these term facilities as the basis for a number of other types of key lending arrangement. This is the basis for the euro loan market. We can also use this in multi-purpose and multi-currency facilities, other term and revolving facilities, credit lines, asset or property finance, including, for example, aircraft and shipping finance, project finance, property and real estate finance, acquisition finance, and then other subordinated arrangements. All of the key terms that then apply in a term structure can be reused, reapplied in any of these other facilities. We are then going to focus on the key sets of conditions and terms within these term agreements. We can understand them basically having regard to three core sets of provisions. We have the financial provisions, we have the obligations, and we have the defaults. And what I do is I go through each of these in the chapter, but I also summarise these on the other documents and tables provided. In terms of the financials, we're basically looking at principal. What's the principal amount? What is the term? What is the interest? And what's the repayment? We can also then add obligations as 5, or we could revise this slightly and insert after 2, we could have drawdown. There's various different types of drawdown conditions that we can apply. We could have principal 1, 2 term, 3 drawdown, 4 interest, and then repayment. The obligations are basically structured in terms of the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the events of default. In relation to these large structured arrangements in the euro-dollar market, because the amounts that are committed are so large, no one bank will want to take on all of the original commitment itself, and therefore we will spread the risk by forming syndicates. The banks will lend in groups or syndicates, and for that reason we need to understand the relationship between the members of the participant. We can then understand that in terms of the syndication principles, which will then be reflected in all of the key terms. All of this we will then structure and set out in the core documentation that's going to be entered into. With regards to documentation, we need to take an initial mandate letter, that's an instruction or appointment letter, to proceed with the facility. We're going to have a term sheet which sets out the outline terms of the documentation and the specific terms and conditions that we're going to incorporate into the loan agreement specifically. We'll have an information memorandum which explains the general background to the borrowers, the borrower's business and activities, the expected use and application of the facility, and the source of income that will be used to generate the funds for the repayment. We will then have the loan document, the loan agreement itself, and I've set out in the chapter the procedure. In terms of the relationship between the institutions, we then have the syndication, we have the basic core principles which support all of the different aspects of this. I summarise that looking at the core documentation, trying to extract all of the key principles. We can review this in terms of 5 core ideas: severality, proportionality, equality, democracy, limited agency function. The limited agency function then corresponds with the duties of the agent bank. We have 3 key sets of bank. We will have an arranging bank or lead bank, which is going to manage the establishment and the creation, setting up of the facility. We have the lending banks, the syndicate banks, which form the lending group. And then we have an agent bank that will administer the facility once everything is set up and entered into. So we have an agent bank, the limited delegation of function that is one of the core aspects of the relationship governing the syndicate members. We can then understand in terms of the specific role and function of the agent bank. These are the same issue from a slightly different perspective. The limited delegation of function by the members of the syndicate, only basically surrendering administrative and core executive and core payment functions and non-executive functions, which will then be carried out by the agent bank. We can then summarise the general principles in terms of severality, proportionality, equality, democracy and limited agency function, and then we transfer the agent functions to the agent bank, and we can summarise those again in terms of 5 key ideas: the receipt duties, the payment duties, the banking duties, notification duties and default duties. I then deal in further detail with loan conditions and obligations. We have the conditions precedent, I've outlined the core provisions that apply, the representations and warranties, we have legal warranties, financial or commercial warranties, and then the ongoing continuing covenants. The key covenants include the corporate covenants, negative pledge, pari passu, disposals, financial, then the financial covenants, we have a separate information covenant, and then a general undertakings provision. We're going to tie all of these provisions to loan default. So we need to then set out, specify a series of default provisions in the documentation. There's a number of standard default clauses that we will always incorporate. Non-payment, breach of financial covenants, non-financial breach, misrepresentation, cross-default, insolvency. Other creditor processes, control, illegality, repudiation, with a general material adverse change clause. There's a number of specific default remedies which can then arise. These are outlined in the documentation. I summarise those in terms of five key ideas. We can have suspension, we can have acceleration, we can have cancellation, we can have rescission, and we can have damages. And we'll come back and look at all of this in further detail, tying this into the relevant case law. We also need to consider how we can transfer loan facilities. We do that through a number of specific devices. These include assignment, legal and equitable assignment, specifically under the Law of Property Act 1925, Section 136, and the conditions imposed. We then also have novation, participation, sub-participation, risk participation, and we could also use securitization and trust as well, although these essentially create alternative economic interests to replace the original interests. We also have to consider more generally other forms of loan structuring and loan rescheduling. So we have voluntary or effectively sort of compulsory rescheduling in the event that one of the borrowers gets into difficulty, including, for example, with regards to a sovereign loan and the country cannot repay all of its debt. We will then have our voluntary rescheduling. There's specific clubs that can assist with this, the London and the Paris clubs, and then there's also specific arrangements made available by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in particular to assist highly indebted low-income countries, and we can come back and look at all of this in further detail. I have summarised all of this again in this diagram, which explains all the key parts of the lending structure and of the facilities that we are looking at. All of the core provisions are outlined on this section, and then we could also understand this more generally in terms of the specific relations between the parties, and then contrast that with a capital market or bond offering rather than a loan facility. The basic loan structure has the borrower or the borrower's group. Usually it will be one company and the subsidiaries. We will have the syndicate lenders who are going to make available the facilities, and then we will have an agent bank who will administer the lending drawdown systems and facilities once the loan agreement is up and running. We will then have a lead or arranging bank who's going to pull all of the parties together, prepare the documentation and have all the documentation entered into and executed. The lead bank or arranging bank then ceases to be involved, it drops out, and the administration of the facilities taken over by the agent bank. So we have syndicate lenders, we have a lead bank, we have the borrower and the borrower's group, and then once the facility is up and running, the administration is taken over by the agent bank. In a capital market transaction, such as a bond offering or an equity offering, the structure becomes more complex because there's more parties involved. We have the investors at the bottom who are going to be purchasing the shares or bonds produced, either private or public. We're going to have the issuing company at the top, which is basically the same as the borrower on the left. What we will then do is, depending upon the size of the offering, we will have a selling group and then possibly a separate underwriting group as well. If there's an underwriting group, we may have an underwriting syndicate, which parallels the lending syndicate and the bond structure. This is basically a group of large banks or securities firms that are going to confirm and guarantee the acceptance sale of the bonds involved. What will happen is we have the selling group is going to try to sell the bonds issued by the issuer directly to the investors, either public or private. In case the selling group cannot dispose of all of the bonds produced, the syndicate underwriting group will undertake to purchase all of these and then place themselves into the market. We have a managing underwriting underwriter if it's a large facility, and we will also have, in this case, a managing or lead bank, which is going to set up all of the arrangements, enter into all the documentation, and ensure that everything's managed effectively before the formal issuance. Once the bonds have then been issued into the market, we're going to have, again, an agent. So we have an agent on the right-hand side that will either be in a bond structure, a fiscal agent or a paying agent. If we have a separate trustee, and the trustee will act on behalf of the investors in a very large bond or equity issue. If there's a trustee, we only need a simple administrative agent, so that will be a paying agent. If there's no trustee, we then still need to set up a trust system, a trust relationship, so that any funds are held in behalf of trust for the investors, we will have a fiscal agent. So if there's a trustee, we have a paying agent. If there's no trustee, we have a fiscal agent. But the fiscal agent then administers the facility, all of the payments, the interest, and any repayments following the entering into and the establishment of the issuance more generally. Before that, we have a lead bank or arranging bank. We then have the managing group and the sales group, who are going to sell the bonds with the managing underwriting, with the underwriting group assuming responsibility for the placement of any bonds not sold by the selling group. And then after all of this is in place, we will have the agent bank administering the facility, and either it will be a paying agent if there's a trustee, or a fiscal agent, which creates a separate trust if there's no trustee. So that's the basic difference between a commercial loan, euro loan facility, and a bond or euro bond facility. We can then understand all of the core parts of the relationship and the documentation in further detail on this table. So essentially, we have the term loan. So this is a term loan structure. We can then use this term loan structure in a series of other applications, and I've outlined, summarized those top right. So we have euro loans, multi-purpose facilities. We have term or revolving facilities. We have credit lines, title finance, project finance, property finance, acquisition finance, securitization, and subordinated debt. We can set up any of these facilities in any of the main international financial centres, such as London, New York, Tokyo, Frankfurt, and Shanghai. The main centre for the international euro dollar market is still London, with over a fifth of the bonds alone being managed through the London markets. The structure then is based on the core parties involved. So we have on the left the borrower and the borrower's group. We have on the right the lenders. The syndicate is going to make the funds available. We have a lead bank or a arranging bank in the middle, who's going to set up all of the structures and enter into all of the documentation concerned. We have the agent bank, who will administer the facility. We will also have guarantors. Usually all of the borrowers will guarantee each other. This can cause difficulty under company law, to the extent that the directors of a company are required only to consider the commercial interests of that company alone and not the larger group. So to some extent, it could be argued that one company providing open guarantees for another company would actually be contrary to the duties to act in the best interest of the first company. In practice, however, what we will do is this. We take resolutions from the board of each of the companies concerned, and the resolutions confirm that it is recognised that by being a participant in this larger facility, we can draw down substantial amounts of funds at low attractive commercial rates of interest, which would not otherwise be available. As part of this facility, we have to provide guarantees to other sister or group companies. So what will happen is, in practice, you will take resolutions which confirm that it's in the best interest for all of the companies concerned to participate in the larger facility, and as a part of that, to provide guarantees to each other. So we've then got the basic structure of the deal. We have the core financial terms in the top left. So we've principal, term, interest, repayment and obligations. As I've already explained, we could also include principal, term, drawdown, interest, repayment and obligations. We then have the obligations are in the bottom right. We have the conditions precedent. We have the representations and warranties, legal warranties and financial and commercial warranties, and then we have the covenants. And the core covenants include the negative pledge clause, the pari passu clause, the disposals clause, financial covenants, information covenants, and general undertakings. The basic way this works is that all of the conditions precedent have to be satisfied at the very beginning. This includes, you will see, taking constitutional documentation from each of the companies concerned. So we need the articles, memorandum of association. We also then need resolutions confirming that the company has decided to enter into this facility, and also confirming the point on guarantees, and that is considered that's in the commercial interest of each of the country's companies involved. We will take separate sovereign confirmations if this is relevant, if it's a state body or if there's any other local permissions required. We will confirm security documentation. We will obtain legal opinions from solicitors in each of the key jurisdictions concerned, confirming that all of the documentation to be entered into is legal and enforceable. We will then take any other separate confirmations or other evidence, and then there may be separate conditions that we impose which have to be complied with afterwards. We will call these conditions subsequent. We then have the representations and warranties. These are basically confirmations of particular situations, as well as warranties or undertakings to carry out other future actions. So we have the conditions precedent, then the representations and warranties, and then the covenants are continuing obligations which apply after the facility has been drawn down. So effectively what happens is we have the CPs of the conditions precedent, the reps and W's, and the covs. It looks like the CPs are pre-loan agreement, the reps and W's pre-drawdown, and the covs post-drawdown. Legally, if you actually read the terms, the way it operates is that the reps and W's are effectively pre-loan agreement, the CPs are pre-drawdown, and the covs are post-drawdown. And we can come back and look at all of this in further detail. We've also then got the core default provisions. We've mentioned these already. Non-payment, financial covenants, non-financial breach, misrepresentation, cross-default, insolvency, creditor processes, control, illegality, repudiation, and the material adverse change clause. The two most significant elements of this, or components of this, are the cross-default in E and the material adverse change clause, the MAC, in K. Cross-default is very important because what it essentially prescribes is that it will be an event of default under this facility if there's an equivalent default under another parallel facility that any of the borrowers are also a party to. What that simply means is that the lenders under this facility will be able to call default and take corrective remedial action in the event that the borrower or any other member of the borrower's group defaults under one of its other key loan agreements. The problem, however, with this is, while it provides a protective condition which assists the lending group, if you call the cross default too quickly, you then trigger all of the cross defaults and all of the other outstanding lending and all of the other outstanding commitments. So lenders have to be careful. They need to manage their cross default clauses. If they trigger too early, that then causes cross default in other facilities, which very often will then mean it's the insolvency of the company, and the company has to be wound up, so they may not receive anything. But again, if they wait too late, this also may cause difficulties because other institutions may get preference. You need to watch the cross default, you need to read the terms of the cross default, and then be able to advise your clients as to whether they should trigger this or not. The MAC clause also causes substantial difficulties very often in negotiation. What you're trying to do is you're trying to predict any possible other separate events, sometimes called, for example, acts of God, which could disrupt the payment flow and the ability of the borrower to make payment. If a MAC arises, you want to be able to call default, but you need to draft the MAC carefully so that it does not include too many other elements and that a default is triggered too simply, too easily, too quickly. Because then again, you have the difficulty with the cross-default provisions. You need to draft these two clauses carefully. You want a good, solid MAC, but you don't want to too widen coverage at the same time, as you want to ensure that it does still protect the legitimate interests and expectations of the lending group. I will give you draft documentation and we can discuss all of this in further detail in the negotiation sessions. We also then have to consider, in particular, you'll see the syndication principles. I've incorporated those on the centre there. This governs the relationship between the syndicate members, severality, proportionality, equality, democracy, limited agency function, which corresponds with the duties delegated to the agent bank. So we can then define the agent functions in terms of receipt duties, payment duties, banking duties, notification duties, and default duties. I've also summarised the key transfer issues at the bottom. So we have assignment, legal or equitable. That's under the Law of Property Act 1925. Section 136 specifies the conditions. For a legal assignment, the transfer must be in writing for a certain unconditional amount and there must be notice given to the borrower. In practice, very often, if banks are involved in these large markets, they will not want to notify the borrower, which will be one of their major clients, that they are transferring on their loan commitments. Therefore, they will not want to give notice. In practice, we then have equitable assignment. Equitable assignment is any form of assignment which doesn't strictly comply with the conditions mentioned, which will specifically include the notice clause. The problem with equitable assignment is that you can then lose priority if another party receives an assignment, a transfer, and gives notice first. But because these transactions tend to be closed, it's a small group of large professional wholesale parties dealing with each other, that tends not to cause any specific problems in practice. You also may have difficulties with the sum being certain and unconditional. Due to the nature of some of the other clauses concerned, there may be conditional provisions imposed, which can actually mean that it's not a certain unconditional amount. Usually, at any one point in time, you can calculate the total amount due to be repaid by the borrowers to the lenders, but there still may be some unconditional elements in there, or some conditional elements, which means the unconditionality clause is not satisfied, and therefore you cannot use equitable assignment. You cannot use legal, and therefore will rely on equitable assignment. The limitation with assignment is that you can only assign benefits, you can only transfer advantages, the points that you will receive under the document. You cannot transfer obligations. You cannot assign obligations. If you want to transfer obligations, we use novation, which means you can cancel one set of relationships and replace them with another. It's a form of substitution. If you want to transfer benefits and obligations, rights and obligations, you use a novation rather than an assignment. A participation arises where one of the lending banks brings in another bank to provide the facilities so those can be made available to the borrower. We can either do that on a disclosed basis or a blind have a blind participation, whereby the borrower still thinks the funds are coming from one bank when in fact they're coming from another bank who's making those funds available to the first bank. We call that a blind participation. A risk participation arises where there's some contingent element, where the amount due is not actually fixed or immediate. This may happen, for example, if there's a guarantee or a performance bond or some other conditional element involved. Once the amount due and the obligation created is fixed, then you would have a participation. Until then, you can have a risk participation. We can also use devices such as securitization and trust, which can transfer legal interest or effectively create alternative legal interest, which substitute for the original loan terms and conditions. The other key issue to highlight is with regards to the content of the documentation. We've mentioned already, we will have, and this is centre left, a mandate letter appoints the lead bank, the agent bank, to set up the facility, to commence negotiations, bring the other banks together, and to negotiate and enter into all of the relevant documentation. The term sheet is an outline summary, initially principally of the key financial terms, which is then exchanged between the borrowers and the banks through the lead bank, which outlines the proposed documentation, the proposed structure of the deal, as well as the key terms to be included in the documentation. In practice now, what tends to happen is the term sheet effectively becomes a summary of the whole facility. It's almost like a mini loan document. It essentially uses the same index as the loan agreement and operates as a summary of the whole loan structure, whole loan relationship that's going to be created, and I can provide copies of this so you can see what a term sheet looks like. The information memorandum is the document that provides the general background information to the facility, which explains to the lending banks the business operations of the borrower and the borrower's group, its financial condition. It will also include information with regards to other outstanding facilities. It will specifically explain the nature of the business of the borrower and the borrower's group, future expected incomes and returns, and then how those will be used to repay the commitment that's been entered into. So the information memorandum provides all the necessary background information to allow the lenders to determine whether they should lend, how much they should lend, and at what price they should lend. This is the fundamental credit assessment process, and this is supported, all of the necessary information to allow that to happen, this key process, is provided in the information memorandum. The key point, which is now dealt with on the right then, is the extent to which the information memorandum may create liability for the parties concerned. A number of particular possible points of liability may arise, either for the lead bank, the arranging bank entering into the facility, or the agent bank that's going to manage the facility subsequently. More generally, we have to consider this in terms of possible theft under the Theft Act, which is deceit. We have fraud, we have negligence, we have innocent misrepresentation, we have fraudulent misrepresentation, and we can also have statutory misrepresentation, and then we also have to consider possible regulatory liability. I have a separate chapter in the book which considers all of these issues. The key point is that we have to be very careful that we do not include any exaggerated points or deliberately, intentionally questionable statements in the court documentation, and in particular in the information memorandum, that may constitute either innocent, negligent or fraudulent misrepresentation or deceit. One of the core functions of the attorneys, the lawyers advising the lead bank specifically, is to ensure that the information that's provided is not exaggerated and is properly supported. We need to confirm, we need to guarantee that no liability can arise on the part of the borrower or the borrower's group in preparing and submitting the information to the information memorandum in the event that a difficulty arises with the facility subsequently. What might happen is if the borrower can't pay or repay, we then have to consider what possible heads of liability can arise. The other banks can only consider suing either the agent bank or the lead bank, so we need to consider their possible heads of liability and we need to be able to manage that liability in practice. There are a series of devices that we can use to limit liability, mainly through contractual provisions. We can have exclusion clauses, we can have what we call basis clauses, which are limited duty clauses, and we can have outright exclusions of liability, all of which are fully enforceable under English law. There are, however, limitations that we have to be careful of, and I've included those on the bottom right. So we have possible fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, we have an Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, and then we have the Misrepresentation Act, which imports a reasonableness test. What will happen is, in the documentation on the centre right, we will attempt to incorporate terms which protect the lead bank and the agent bank. These will include exclusion of liability clauses, but we have to be careful that we do not exceed the limits on what is possible in law to exclude liability for. There are certain terms that we cannot exclude liability in relation to, and then also we have to be careful about importing these reasonableness interpretations into the construction of the clauses, and I deal with all this in further detail in the separate paper provided on liability. What we can then do is this: we're going to establish a facility, we're going to set out all of the rights and obligations and duties of all of the parties concerned. We can do all of that in the core documentation involved. We can then either do this in the form of a euro loan deal or on a capital market or euro bond deal. A number of other important issues arise, which will then be revealed as part of the negotiation. We then use the negotiation process to highlight particular points of fact, an issue that may arise with regards to the particular borrower and borrower's group. But what we can then do is, through intelligent, careful, informed, responsible and professional negotiation, we can develop a facility that suits all of the parties involved, and then we can record all of that in the documentation that will be entered into, and we can do all of that having regard to all of the specific points and issues outlined on this table and in the chapter provided.